This is Eat Out In.
Well, remember when eating was simple? You ate when you were hungry, you ate until you were full, usually meat and three veg, no snacking in between. When did we lose our way? When did food become a fad? Why is eating healthily so complicated these days? No carbs, no dairy, low fat, zero sugar, vegan, vegetarian, meat only, organic, free range. Confused? Well, my guests tonight on Eat Out In are going to help us cut through the confusion. Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard care deeply about the food we eat and particularly about how we care for the animals we eat. That may seem unusual considering they're both butchers, but for partners Laura and Grant, meat eating doesn't mean destroying the planet. In their new cookbook, The Ethical Omnivore, they explain that knowing how our food is produced, its provenance, is essential for healthy eating. And Laura and Grant join me now. Welcome, guys.
Thanks so much, Indira.
Well, firstly, I want to quiz you. What meal did you have before this chat? And would you be able to tell me where it came from?
I've got a very terrible, Grant can answer in a very virtuous and holier than thou way. And I have to admit to the dreadful sin of, I just ate a piece of cake.
No, that's good. You're human like the rest of us. What about what you ate, Grant?
I had reheated chicken roast, sort of baked chicken. It was like a casserole with white beans that I'd cooked from Summerlad Heritage Chickens a couple of nights ago and had bought the balance in for a rushed lunch at work, which is generally all I get time to do.
Right. So you obviously know where those chickens came from.
I do. And the people who raised them, Brian and Kim, they're owners, so to speak. They breed them on the farm. They breed, incubate, grow and kill. It's completely done on the one farm as a sealed system.
Now, most of us wouldn't be able to say that, wouldn't be able to say where that last meal that we ate, where it came from, how it was grown and prepared. But as you both explain in The Ethical Omnivore, that is one of the problems with our food system now. We've become so disengaged. How has that happened, Grant?
It's really a process of the industrialization of the food system, which has taken place since the 70s, especially, or 60s. Post-Second World War was the start of it, and everything got bigger and the genetics became privately owned. There was a sort of a move away from traditional farming, which was always sort of valued the mixture of crops and animals on a farm, because animals, after all, the most efficient nutrient cyclers. Compost works very well, but it can take, you know, weeks at best and months at worst. Animals sort of do that overnight, and that the role they play in an ecosystem is vital, along with everything else, of course, along with the birds, the insects, bats, rats, mice, and then right down under the ground to the microbes and fungi that exchange nutrients and basically give life to soil, which gives life to the things that grow upon it and eat it, and effectively give life to us.
Now, the soil is so critical, Laura. Why is soil so important?
Well, I suppose if you look at it from a literal perspective, it's the foundation of everything. You know, it's what we walk on. It's the platform for everything, really. And if the soil isn't in, you know, a sort of a vital, vibrant, healthy, well-balanced condition, then it doesn't allow purchase for all the plants that grow within it. It doesn't allow, if it's not full of air and moisture, then, you know, plant roots can't permeate down to access the minerals and nutrients that they need to then cycle back up through the plant to then feed all the creatures that live above the surface of the soil. You know, it's the starting point, it's the anchor. And in our book, we talk about the realization that sort of dawned on us over a period of time. As we visited the farms we became involved with, what struck us was how so many of them seemed to place So, you know, the most important thing for them was the condition of the soils, because the soils was where the fertility sprang from.
Well, I love it in your book, one of your suppliers, Rob Lennon, an organics Wagyu farmer from Gundooey in New South Wales, describes himself as, I'm a microbe farmer, he says. I don't grow beef, I grow soil.
Well, that's right. And this is this common denominator amongst all of these regenerative farmers with whom we work. They're in some ways much less interested in the animal or the product that they're growing to sell, you know, for food, than they are in the condition of their soils, because they understand that if your soils aren't healthy and don't then lend fertility and vitality to the rest of your ecosystem, then the thing that you're growing to make money from in turn also won't be healthy. So it's this central idea that everything is connected. It's a series of communities of interconnected creatures. And unless you have, you know, balance and between all of those things, then nothing is really healthy. So they consider themselves to be soil farmers, not sheep farmers or cattle farmers or chicken farmers, you know. That's the thing.
And when you talk about those communities that are all interconnected, Laura, that microbial life in the soil is also vital as well. Tell us the role those microbes play in our health.
Well, yes. I think it's very interesting, isn't it? You know, there's some really, really interesting work being done. It's been going on for decades now, but it's starting to sort of filter out into the broader community through all sorts of interesting books, like a really good one, actually, that the director of the Charles Perkins Centre, it's in university, published recently. And it's work that animal behaviourists and biologists are doing around the instincts that animals have for self-medication. So animals instinctively understand that you need to eat this thing or that thing at any given time to give you the sorts of chemicals and nutrients and minerals that you need to stay healthy and to feed your gut biota. And we seem to have forgotten how to do that largely, which speaks to the initial thing that you were talking about in your introduction. You know, we sort of don't seem to know how to eat anymore. We have to prescribe all these different complicated ways of eating rather than just being in touch with our instinct and understanding that our guts need certain things at different times and searching out those foods, which is what animals do in a paddock, you know.
And what goes wrong when our gut microbes get out of balance, Laura? What are you seeing your customers saying to you?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, it feels to us like an epidemic. I mean, I think that's partly because we have a fairly particular group of customers. But you only have to look, you know, online at all of the different diets and all the different responses to see that it's not just us. There are so many issues that people have which seem to be to do with nutrition, you know, autoimmune issues, you know, mental health issues, this growing understanding that our guts are effectively a second brain, and the health of your gut determines the health of your entire system, is starting to lead to a much more sort of respectful understanding about what we put into our bodies and how that determines the ecosystem of our bodies and the health of that ecosystem. So we see a lot of people with all sorts of issues, incredible issues around asthma and, you know, allergies and just lots and lots of different things. And they're all looking for really, really clean food with a really short supply chain, without additives, without preservatives, whether that's, you know, plant or animal-based foods. It, these ideas apply across the board, because plant-based foods can be just as riddled with, you know, pollutants and problems as animal-based foods.
And Grant, if I can come back to you, when you've eaten a chicken, the chicken that you had today, obviously you can taste a difference between that chicken and a chicken that's been raised in a cage environment, but there's also such a difference in the nutrients that chicken holds, isn't there?
Well, there's a number of factors at play. One of the key things about the chicken that I was eating and from that particular grower was the different genetic base that they're bred from. Effectively, 95% of the chicken the world eats is one or two breeds that are American-owned genetics for a very, very fast-growing chicken. So much so that, you know, the average length of time has basically halved in the last 30 years for that chicken to get to about a 1.6 or a size 16 chicken that you might buy in a shop.
Mm.
And that's happening in 4.5 weeks now, which is an incredibly fast time to go from a few gram, yeah, that's right, 1-day-old chick to a bird that might feed 4 or 5 people. And to do that, you know, that you don't in breeding changes, you don't get everything. There's always a loss. If you're breeding for rapid meat growth, you won't necessarily get fantastic sort of bone structure, and that's one of the problems that new sort of genetic chickens have. So the emphasis on the older chicken, they are slower growing, but they're much stronger and have much more vitality. They can breed naturally, which new chickens can't do.
New chickens. So can I just say that the chickens, for example, in Australia, all of the meat chicken that we eat, without exception, is one or two of these almost indistinguishable Cobble Ross breed white broilers. You know, so that gives you an idea of the landscape. Sorry.
That's right. So if a bird is feeding, and the whole point of the Summerlad chicken was to try and bring back a meat bird that could thrive in Australian conditions, and summers now where these birds are grown, which is out of Wellington in the central west of New South Wales, commonly gets temperatures in the mid-40s and a bit higher. Now, a conventional chicken is going to really struggle at those temperatures because they find it very hard to regulate their heat. Because they're designed to grow in an air-conditioned shed. In fact, they don't have that sort of... That's not one of the concerns that the animal breeders or the bird breeders have. But for a chicken that's foraging naturally and scratching and looking for grubs and insects, as chickens want to do, this different set of breed characteristics allows them the vitality and the structure and resilience in their genetic structure to be able to deal with 45 degree heat, but also deal with, you know, very cold nights as well. So we get a much better chicken out of that. The meat structure is very different. The bone structure is certainly very different. They're slower growing. Yes, they're more expensive, and their nutrient quality. That's really the next area, is to actually compare and to do really rigorous research, and there is research being done on this, especially in England, really rigorous research about relative nutrient levels in all the foods that we eat. And because it's true to say that just as the soils are depleted, the animals that rely on that soil are equally depleted, and that applies to grains, vegetables, and legumes, which have lost their, you know, grains especially, their protein content has been reduced by about 25% in the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, so Grant, the other thing that you and Laura are passionate about at the Feather and Bone Butchery is to emphasise and encourage the whole animal consumption rather than just a piece of breast or a leg. Why is that important to you?
Well, from a purely commercial point of view, as we're buying the whole carcass, we need to sell the whole carcass, not necessarily in one piece, although that might happen with a chicken, clearly, but very rarely in the case of, say, beef. And so our job is to break that animal down and sell all of those constituent parts to different people. And, you know, we have markets for people who just buy bones to make their bone broth. We have markets for people who just want really clean, fresh organ meat, for instance, and others who are looking for a really sort of, you know, spectacular aged piece of ribeye or something like that. So unless we can sell the whole animal, one, we're not doing the animal justice and not sort of, entering into the contract, which is when you kill something, you need to value it and use the whole animal. And two, we'd be out of business pretty quickly if we can only sell one cut from that, you know, enormous animal. So a 300 kilo carcass of beef, for instance, that we get, which is an older animal than mostly is available, that if you want eye fillet, that's about 4 kilos on that body. So 1.3% of its body weight is eye fillet. Now, that's about how often you should eat it. And I would hazard to guess that most people eat eye fillet or something like a T-bone that includes the eye fillet more often than 1.3 times out of 100.
Mm. That is a very good point. Important to eat the whole beast. And Laura, if I can come back to you, the other interesting thing from your book, The Ethical Omnivore, is that, you know, you say that everyone talks about sustainable farming practices, but what you champion are regenerative practices. Tell us what you see as the difference.
Well, I think, again, as we said before, it comes back to this idea of seeing the parcel of land over which you have jurisdiction for, you know, or over which you are, of which you're the custodian, viewing it as an ecosystem where every single thing within that ecosystem has a right to, you know, to be given the best chance to achieve its genetic potential. It's about trying to create the perfect balance between all of those different elements, you know, the microbes, the insects, the, you know, the birds, the thing you're growing for food, everything. And so a lot of regenerative farmers see their job really as getting out of the way of nature. So you do as little interference as you possibly can. Everything you do is all about creating, giving room for nature's superior ability to self-organize, you know, the best opportunity to get in there and do its thing best. So, you know, that's a very simplistic way of talking about it. It's, I suppose, about, it's about systems which reduce the amount of inputs in favor of a system which can manage fertility and viability without intervention, you know.
Yeah. Now, your book, The Ethical Omnivore, has about, what, 60 nose-to-tail recipes to help us explore all these aspects of ethical meat eating better. What's the recipe that you guys want to share with us tonight?
As I said to you at the very beginning of this, it's incredibly difficult because one of the things, I just tell you a little story. When we started doing this book, our publisher said, it's important that you put recipes in this book. And we struggled with that for a little bit because we're not chefs. I mean, we obviously talk about cooking all the time and we give our customers instructions about cooking and so on. But we are not chefs and we don't pretend to be. So the idea of going out and, you know, saying that we had a whole lot of recipes, it was a little bit strange. And it took us a while, but then we realized that actually the answer was staring us in the face because this book is about the it's about the interconnectedness of things and communities and about trying to encourage people to see the world as interconnected communities of living creatures that all need to be considered in order for the whole thing to be healthy and vital. And so we thought, well, it's obvious. We'll just talk to our community need to write these recipes and contribute these recipes. And so that's what we did. So the recipes in our book, some of which come from us, mostly come from all the people who are part of our sort of broader family. They're our customers, they're the chefs we work with, they're farmers we work with, and they all have just these marvelous stories about the recipes that they put forward, beautiful stories. So it's very difficult to choose one or another because not only do we love all the recipes, but the stories are so gorgeous. Anyway, I think there's a good one that I would probably put forward, which is it's actually a liver recipe from one of our customers. And he's an interesting fellow because he is now, he's an artist and he owns a gallery, and but he's the son of a butcher. And so when he was a kid, his job on Saturday mornings was to cook up breakfast for his father. And it was a terrible proposition because his father was obviously a good cook and knew all about meat and how to cook it and so on. And he was this kid who had to cook up the lamb's fry and the kidney and so on. And but he's given it a twist in his creative way, and it's seared liver with tomatoes and caramelized onions, and it's absolutely delicious. So we have a lot of conversations with people about offal in our butchery because we have offal, so people who are searching for it come to us. And the other thing about offal, of course, is, you know, they're organs that that filter toxins and do all sorts of things. And so you want them to come from very clean animals, so people do seek us out. But it's also organ meats and offal are something that people no longer really know how to cook and don't eat very commonly.
That's right.
So it's really lovely when you come across somebody who embraces it and really knows what to do with it. And I think his recipe is lovely. It's very, very simple. It's just it's just liver, veal or calf or goat or lamb liver, so something quite sort of gently flavoured. And it's braised onions, tomato, and it's like a sort of a brunch or a breakfast meal, and it's gorgeous.
Mm, sounds delicious. I love my liver, actually, and yours is the first offal recipe that we've had on Eat Out In, so thank you very much for sharing that with our listeners. That recipe will be uploaded onto our Nightlife website, and join all the other recipes from all our international and national cooks and chefs that have shared their lovely recipes with Nightlife listeners. Thank you very much, Laura and Grant, for talking to Nightlife tonight.
Thanks so much, Indira.
Thank you, Indira.
Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard, the authors of Ethical Omnivore. They're Sydney butchers, and their butchery Feather and Bone specialises in wonderful meat that has been grown with a lot of care for the animals and also the soil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.